I'm here, been invited to the village to share what I know about the Enneagram, which is a Greek word for nine, the gram of nine. And I got into it when I was here in the village. I discovered it. I was looking for some different schools of maybe following a spiritual directorship course in my life. And this is being offered at the University of Loyola by the Jesuits. I thought, well, it's got to have some validity to it then. It's not like studying astrology or some of the other things that some people have a lot of faith in, and other people kind of want to do a number on them. The Enneagram is very old in the sense that they don't know for sure how old it is. The Sufis used it. That's the Sufis are the monastic segment of the Muslim religion. And the Sufis have used it for a long time in helping their disciples find God. Then Gurdjieff, who is a contemporary spiritual leader in our Western culture, who is highly controversial, used it with his disciples. From there, one of his disciples went to Chile and was teaching it there down in the university. He taught it in Chile and also in Bolivia. And he was teaching it down there when there was a group from the Catholic Church went down and was exposed to it. And they brought it to the United States in 1972. It has always been an oral tradition. There's never been anything written on it until around the mid-80s. Oh, I've got about six or seven books here. All of them have all been published in the late 80s or last year. The important thing of it for me was how incredibly helpful. It takes the part of our personality, instead of like so much of today's self-help and everything, lifts us up, makes us feel good, and tells us what a great person we are. This particular tradition points your finger at me and said, "You jerk, you dummy, this is where you were constantly screwing up in your relationships. There are things that I wasn't conscious I was doing, and yet there was things that I knew I was doing, but I thought they were so helpful. And then when I get into a conflict, I would use it all that much more, and at the same time, it was actually probably adding fuel to the conflict, but I was trying to put water on it, and I was trying to put out the fire with gasoline, or else throwing water on an oil fire, I'm not sure. One of my favorite phrases was, basically I was using a shovel to try to dig myself out of the hole. And it seems that so much of the time in our relationships, we have a favorite behavior that we know works. The other person has their favorite behavior, and they know that works, and you bump against each other. And if that didn't work to solve the conflict, you bump a little harder. And you keep bumping really until you know you're not getting anywhere, and you can't figure out what's wrong. The Enneagram sorted all this out into nine personality types. The nine come from they start with nine at the top because it's not a hierarchy. It is, one is equal to the other. The reason they call them by numbers is because there is definitely very advantageous to this action. There's advantageous parts of it. For myself, I'm a giver, and that is completely wonderful in the right situation. But it also, at the same time, can be very, very manipulative. And so a giver also has a lot of pride involved. So on the front end of it, you could call it very prideful. On the other end of it, a giver. So in naming it, you're going to give it its own aspects, its own personality in that respect, rather than honoring it for both sides of the coin. And so they put numbers on them so that you would recognize both sides of the coin at the same time, rather than just the heads of the or the tails, you know it's a penny. And the way I'm planning on doing this course is I'm going to divide the 9 up into 3 segments each night. And there isn't a test to take. Are any of you familiar with Myers-Briggs? Mm-hmm. Okay, for those of you that aren't, Jung came out with a theory on personalities. And now they have available a lot of different tests that you can take. And after you're finished taking the tests, you basically understand that you're either an extrovert or an introvert. If you do all your decision making by thinking, or if you do your decision making from feelings, that type of thing. Well, the Enneagram is more of telling stories, telling modes of behavior, and when you find the one that probably steps on your toes, offends you, that's probably the one that you need to work on. The 3 that I will start out with are the 3 that are motivated by anger. That will be the 8, 9, and 1. When people are of these 3 personality types, anger is how their reaction to any type of stress or anxiety. When they're out of their comfort zone, they will use anger to try to get back into their comfort zone. The 2, 3, and 4, I tried every way in the world writing this on the board, as they use anger, the 2, 3, and 4 have depression. They submit, they just crawl inside of a hole and feel sorry for themselves. The 6, 7, and 8 use fear. They try to run away from the situation, avoid it. So you've got the old fight, flight, or submit. The three types of activity that usually happens when a person is outside their comfort zone. These behaviors are usually well-tuned when we're about the age of 4. This is something that, as far as which one we are, we find one that works in our family system between the ages of 4 and 6. By right, we have all of this, all of us do. And the challenge of being able to automatically come to the point where we use the appropriate behavior for each situation rather than our habitual behavior. And in my own particular case, being the giver, where I came to that was during the ages of 4 and 6. My parents were chronically ill. I was the last child, and I was, they were really very ill. They've taken care of the rest of the kids. So if I wanted to be in the room and have attention, I had to be a little nurse and bring water or maybe rub my mom's back or do something to be helpful. And when I gave, then I got the attention and the nurturing I needed. And so there I became the 2, and I thought it worked great through my life. It didn't. Before I get too far down the road, does anybody have any input or questions that would like to? I'd love to make this a discussion group and have a lot of storytelling, because it's through each other's stories that we also recognize who we are.
I kind of have the impression that you're saying something predominates. I mean, we all have all of them, right?
Yes. Huh. Yes. It usually, at some point, if we're in a real stress situation, or especially in relationships with another person, or a group of individuals, it could be our leadership style or our non-leadership style. Mm-hmm. It's that type of thing. Mm-hmm. You had a question.
I had a question about anger. Generally speaking, I don't deal with things that way at all.
Mm-hmm.
And could you give an example of when anger would be appropriate?
Or how it's done in childhood, between the ages of 4 and 6. How does a child between 4 and 6 acquire this?
Tantrums. The anger, well, one of the things that, okay, like with anger here, between these three here, and this is something I'll get more into, but each one of these three, like the 8, is the person who externalizes everything. That person doesn't take responsibility for anything in their life. Everybody else, everything else is at fault. The 9 is completely out of touch with anger, denies it totally, relates to everybody, soaks it up, and basically is unable to move in the anger because they don't even admit their anger. The 1 totally denies anger and internalizes it and just beats themselves up instead. So your 8, being the external person who reaches out to the world to take care of them, lashes out, wants to be a controller, and if I talk about it too much, I'm not going to have anything to teach tomorrow night.
Well, how is the 1 different from depression?
Pardon me?
How is the 1, the self-beater-upper, different from depression? That sounds like depression.
It's not, because the ones, basically, instead of going into depression, have resentment. Whoops!
Oh, that's funny. But you don't see depressive people as having resentment, then?
Oh, we do, yeah. There is depression. The difference between anger and depression, in a lot of ways, well, basically, I think anger comes to, depression does have anger in it, anger has depression in it. Depression, I'm using it here, is more of a roll over and play dead.
Just a withdrawal.
There's a hopelessness out there. There's no hope.
So, you used submission earlier. That might be mm-hmm. a better word up there.
Okay.
I wanted to comment on the question here about children. I think that one of the problems has been, at least in our culture, that especially with the Christian culture, is that anger in the Catholic Church, of course, is one of the 7 sins or something.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a great negative feeling about anger, even though anger is there. And my daughter, I tell her it's okay to be angry. There's nothing wrong with that. You can't hit me with it, but you tell them, and I do tell her that it's okay. And she's learned that much better than I did, because if I'm angry at her, I kind of hold on to that for hours. And she can be angry with me, and she can let go of it very quickly. And I'm just angry, and then the next minute it's gone, let's go do something else.
Does she say, I'm very angry?
She doesn't necessarily reply to that directly, but I mean, she would be clearly angry. I mean, you can see it and you can hear it in the voice. It isn't necessarily the point where she will say, I am angry, but she knows, I mean, she's been told repeatedly that that's okay, that it isn't wrong or sinful.
But isn't that a way of dealing with anger, to just verbalize it, to say, I'm very angry about this?
Mm-hmm. But first, if you have the ability to recognize mm-hmm. it and give yourself permission, mm-hmm. that's the part that a lot of our culture, number one, recognizing it, because we've been told it from such an early age, anyway I was, that you cannot be angry. That is not being a good little Christian. You do not get angry. And so I stuffed it. And so first I've got to recognize that I'm angry, and then I have to give myself permission that it's okay to be angry. And that's been a hard role for me. to hold, but I'm getting there. Whoops. Is that okay?
We did it.
They're alive, let's face it.
I feel something that I call depression. I live alone. I lost my husband 3 years ago. And every time I enter that empty house, I've been traveling for 3 years.
Uh-huh.
And every time I come back to that empty house, it like paralyzes me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that house. And I can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got plenty of things to do.
I may be talking off base on this, but to me, maybe more the depression that you're dealing with has not so much to do with your normal behavior as just part of the grieving process.
It takes a long time.
That it's just a natural part of grieving that needs to be embraced and moved through rather than fighting against.
Well, I felt that I had gone through
mm-hmm.
grieving, but maybe I haven't.
Mm-hmm. It took my father 7.5 years after my mother died.
Yeah.
Because I keep telling myself, now if you go out and take a walk and come back, you'll feel like doing something, but I can hardly get myself to go out and take a walk.
I might, talk to your pastor if you know somebody that has some good tools for grieving. Would be the way I would encourage you to take care of it.
In my house.
Take them outside on the porch.
I had a thought a minute ago I was going to share, and now it's...
What was helpful to me, Paula, when you first explained this to me, was to think about myself in a... Well, first thing that was interesting is that I could identify people that I was close to, everybody else, but I had trouble with me. And then, as Paula was explaining this to me, I thought about, when you're in the middle of the worst conflict, or, just something that feels really yucky, do you submit to it? Do you run away from it? Or do you fight it? And that sort of helped me sort of, at least I knew which three, for me it was more I submit. And so at least it gave me, my primary defense against stress when I'm really beyond my comfort zone will either be a 2, a 3, or a 4, and then I can listen to those characteristics in there and see which one sort of sounds like it fits me most.
It doesn't vary whether it's with your boss or your child or your dog or your mother. It seems like I could do all those three, but it would be with a different person.
Mm-hmm.
Like submit to your boss, get angry with your wife, and get timid. Get timid with your child. Yeah, always be careful of making a mistake.
Well, sounds pretty healthy.
When as Paula was explaining to me, I just had a lot of curiosity. I came to this with a lot of curiosity, and she would describe each one, and I was like, well, I do that sometimes,
mm-hmm.
but then there's one that's just like, yeah, that's it.
I came across a great quote that this is what I was thinking of a minute ago that I wanted to share with you, because anger. I feel like, there's an echo. Is that, are you hearing an echo?
I'm hearing.
Oh, okay. Tape ministry is supposed to be on duty, so hopefully they'll get that. I think it's gone. I'm sorry, it's distracting me a little bit.
Open up your arms a little bit. I think it's because of
the
way you're sitting.
Oh, okay.
No?
No,
it might be that. Is this mic on also?
That is a separate mic for the... tape. They tape all the sessions, so this is just an extra one so that you can hear a little better. But using the three, anger, and here in this quote, he called it desire versus what I was calling submission, or fear And it says, the usual way to generate force is to create anger, desire, and or fear. But these are dangerous sources of energy because they are blind, whereas the force of love springs from awareness and does not destroy in its own aims. And that is that whole thing about when we are in a situation of stress or out of our comfort zone, that if we have fear, or we submit, those are perfectly healthy, because it's like God or our psyche calling us for change. And changes are necessary. But the changes need to be made appropriately. The energy needs to be turned and used in a healthy way, not in a destructive way. And that's really more of what we're aimed at here, is so we can pinpoint this behavior so that we can turn and use it in a healthy manner. I think what I'm going to do, just to kind of, I don't think this thing's going to fall off. On the 9, I'm going to give you the two words, the positive and the negative, of the description of each of these, just to kind of start some thought for you. The number 8, the negative one. Oh, nice chalk here.
Like the negative characteristic of an 8?
Yeah, is the boss. The positive, when it's converted or through a conversion, becomes a leader. The 9, because of their inability to move and making decisions, would be a sloth. That's a nice healthy term, isn't it? If it's into a conversion, becomes the peacemaker. The 1, becomes the critic. Did I spell that right?
Mm-mm.
I didn't think so.
I see.
Oh, that's how
I
see. There we go. The critic. Or it can become the pathfinder. The 2, the giver, let's see, that's kind of a giver with pride, or a partner. The 3, it's just basically deceit. Always have trouble with I before you hear you after I. Or it becomes the motivator. The 4 uses envy. Or the envy or the tragic romance is my favorite. This term for this one, N-I-T-A-I-T. The positive term is the potentiator. P-O-I-A-T. Yeah, okay. The number 5 is the hermit. Or the explainer. The 6, devil's advocate, or the stabilizer. Number 7, gluttony, generalizer. Call him the generalizer. E-R, or the celebrator. The intuitive styles on these top three is usually the body. 2, 3, and 4, you can kind of tell from later on, is the heart or feelings. And then 5, 6, and 7 is the head and uses thinking. They think themselves in. These guys feel themselves into the holes, these guys think themselves in the holes, and these guys do themselves into the hole. So, well, we've got, let's see, what have we got? We've got till 7:15. So we've got about a half hour of, we can get further into this. How many people want to go further into this as just an overview, since they're going to be leaving like in the next day or two? I can, and then are we going to, or we can take it, you know, much more in detail. But my plan was to take like 8, 9, and 1, really dissect them and then discuss them. And then Wednesday take 2, 3, and 4, same thing, 5, 6, and 7, and then on Friday just pull it all together and say, okay, now I've figured out what my mode of operandum is, what do I do about it, where do we go from here?
Will you always be on at 6:15?
No, like tomorrow I'm on at 10:15. It's different each day. I don't know exactly why they did it, why the schedules are made that way, but
I wonder if neither one of us can go there.
Yeah.
If we leave Wednesday, do you have a book?
Yeah, that's something that, can I borrow your copy for a second? There's about 6 books available, and from my reading experience of them, the one that I found to be the most useful, especially for the layperson, is this one here. It's called The Enneagram, A Journey of Self-Discovery, and they did get it into the bookstore. It is available there. And also, this is one of my favorite subjects. Please don't hesitate to come up and ask me questions. I love to talk about it. So at coffee break, or if you just see me walking around the village, I love to talk about this stuff. So
libraries have that kind of book.
Pardon me?
General libraries.
My experience of in my neighborhood, I live in the Seattle area, and I live up in the northern half. The Whidbey Island Library, which is the Snow Isle Library, which is Snohomish County and the Island County, they have nothing on the Enneagram, and also the Everett Library didn't have anything. Pardon?
Working County.
Okay, you might have something because you're probably, you know, a much bigger county, so possibly there is. If not, any of your, even like Walden bookstores, yeah. And what I wanted to do is, I've got available a bibliography that has the different books that I've got here that you guys can thumb through too, and see, because some of them, of course, go more into the religious background of it. They even take Jesus as the example and showing all the positive sides of the Enneagram of, okay, as he used anger in the temple, leadership with the disciples, and all the different aspects of a healthy version of who we can be. And so that one of the books takes it on that way. One of the books that is available, and this is why I'm telling you in case you order it, because one of the books was extremely, wasn't even academic, as it took, later when we get into this, there is a movement of arrows of how organizations work using the same diagram, and it talks about the movement from one segment to the other through for organizations. Then another one is extremely much more clinical, works with the pathologies and the neurotics, and which ones become neurotic and which ones, you know, become the mass killers, which ones commit suicide. So of finding the one that just suited to your interests, I brought them along so that you can kind of thumb through them and find what appeals to you in this order.
I would like to know a little bit of the history of this.
Okay.
System.
Okay. A little bit more about it is, there, like I said, there isn't a whole lot written about it until his name is I-C-H-A-Z-O. Brushes across it on occasion, but there still wasn't a lot written about it. The one thing that...
Where did it come from?
Originally, mm-hmm. was through the Muslim tradition. Mm-hmm. Sufi tradition is where it's first really recognized. Mm-hmm. And that's where Gurdjieff encountered it. Mm-hmm. And when he was studying with some Sufis somewhere in the Middle East. And then the main person who brought it to the United States was, there's two people, Claudio Narao, who was a MD, who's went to Chile. And then as far as on the, in the church aspect, or the where we picked it up, the Christianity picked it up, was, let me think, Robert O-C-H-S, Oates, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. And he was a Jesuit, and there were several Jesuits went down and learned it together. And they are using it, like I said, at the University of Loyola. There are several places in California that have it, that they teach it. Or it's not really something that you teach, as it is you experience. You share and you experience. And in the oral tradition, apparently a lot of the gurus never shared the entire Enneagram with any one disciple until they were very, very far advanced. What they would do is, of course, in that culture, or even like with monks, where you have a guru and a disciple, you live with these people, you know them inside out. And at that point, the guru would then point the finger at his disciple and tell him all the things that he need to clean up in his act. And what with the day and age, how we have, all of us being probably on our spiritual journeys, we're moving too fast, and we don't have that time to commit to a spiritual journey to that depth. And so we have come to a culture where we need things in writing where we can study them on our own. And become more involved in it.
Was the primary purpose for identification then, or was it designed also with the, you know, what you were saying before, what to do afterwards approach, you know, do they include that as well?
Yes. Yes, it does. I think for myself, I will tell you, like I said, I'm a two, I'm a giver. And of really recognizing the behavior that I get into when I'm in a tight spot, of recognizing that, and then of seeing the red flag, of being able to identify the flags when they come up, when I start getting into this mode, of that way I can backpedal, look back, and then like use the fives approach of back off, observe, get a more objective view on it, and then possibly move up, take control of the situation, and move on it. We do it like in the nanosecond. It's not something that we consciously work through. But the thing of it is, we get stuck in one behavior, and we never move out of it. If we move out of it, then all the rest of it just kind of picks up and flows on its own. And it's just getting unstuck is what we're after. And I thought I saw a hand. The thing that is that these are not just dyed in the wool. It's either this, but at the same time, instead of being just exactly a one, very possibly there's the wings where you might be lean over here, where you're a little bit of the giver, but yet you're the critic. You're but they refer to it as you're a 2-ish 1 or a 1-ish 2, or you might be a 3-ish 2, this type thing. And so if you pick up a little bit of one and yet you think you're kind of the other, it's probably true. But that only works with the neighboring number, because it doesn't work across. Now there's times that you might think that you're one instead of the other. In like the critic, the number one and the number three have some real similar traits, but their base motivation is different. A number one's base motivation comes from wanting to change the world to make it better. The number three is much more self-oriented. They are interested in changing themselves. The number one is interested in changing the world, but they're both going to go at it with some real hard energy. And why am I looking at you when I say that?
Because I'm a three.
I would be really interested in having a quick go around the rest of the circle.
Okay, I'll do a quick overview then. Okay, the one, the critic, is, I'm going to let them remain nameless, but some people that I know. She is the model mother. She still fixes breakfast for her daughter, who is now 15 years old. She still packs her lunch for her, too. She is a social worker who is very much into taking care of family violence, working with family violence. She is my housemate, and we have a great time together, but I am a much more spontaneous person. She can be very rigid. She has the box, and this is the way it is supposed to be done. This is the way I was taught it was done, and this is the way it is supposed to be done. And you give me a rule, I'm going to break it. And she never gets mad, but yet at the same time, there's just kind of this this feeling of resentment. You can tell that she is not a happy camper about what I'm doing, but you never know it. She doesn't communicate about it. We've talked about it later, and she always thinks it through, but at the same time you can just tell that there is just this horrendous aura of disapproval. I know that she doesn't approve of what I'm doing, but she won't admit it at the time. After we talk about it, she goes, yeah, there was some problems that I was feeling there. But she's basically working with her own internal judgment. She intellectually knows that what's going on, but yet experientially she hasn't been able to integrate the two. So she's still the critic. She will be the one that puts the fine touches on a meal. She's the garnishment, because it's got to be perfect. Close isn't good enough. It's got to be perfect. That's how she finds her comfort.
Excuse me, why do you call her a critic then, rather than, say, a perfectionist?
A perfectionist
Why the word critic?
Because everything has to go through a critique. Everything has to be compared to
better. So she's a critiquer.
Yeah, oh yeah. Right. Everything is, and there's always, nothing is good enough. Everything, the critic comes in the fact that she's critical of it. That she compares it to something that's better, and it can always be improved.
Yeah.
I'm, like I said earlier, I'm the giver. And in relationship, when the relationship starts going sour, I start giving. I give. I don't recognize my own needs. I take care of everybody else's needs. Gosh, are you cold? Take my coat. And then I'm going to sit over here and freeze. Oh, you're still cold? Take my socks. And then you walk away with my coat and socks on. I said, that jerk didn't even appreciate it. We use giving to manipulate. If I give enough, then you will be appreciative and then you will owe me. If that isn't good enough, then I'll get sick and then you'll feel sorry for me. All of these have, like I said, the upside of them. The critic becomes the pathfinder because it's through their vision of a more perfect situation. We have some place, we have goals for something better. As far as the two and the giver, geez, what would the world be without Mother Teresa? I'm not Mother Teresa, but it's a great goal.
Mm-hmm. Could that be called a people pleaser?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, it's hard to come up with. I like that. That's a good one. The three, another name for the three is the performer. They will take on the facade of whatever the task is that they need to perform. You were talking that you've decided that you're a three, I don't really see you changing your facade that much. But
success.
But your
and efficiency are very important.
In fact, I'm trying to think, there's another three that I know who compartmentalizes when they're at work and they're a bookkeeper. They are a total bookkeeper. When they are bicycling, I mean, complete the total outfit. I mean, we've got the stretch pants, we got the biking shoes, we've got everything that's, I mean, you have to have all the right accoutrements. I hear somebody laughing over here.
I don't think it's like that.
Okay. Success. I mean, it's the image. The image is their identity. That is the performer. Success is, without success, there is no self-value. That is what we're made up of. The fours are the tragic romantics. The past or the present is always much, much better than the past or the future is much, much better than the present. They have a real hard time living in the present. They are a lot of times very melancholy. I've got a girlfriend who has been in out of love several times. But she's much happier when she's out of love because then she's in pain, and she loves her pain. Oh, she just really thrives on it. The four is the hermit. You always, in a lot of times in most groups, find the person who's always one or two steps outside the group, observing, never participating, just taking in all the information. They thrive on information, but they're afraid to share it. They're usually the misers in our society too. You might find the one that on a real far end of on the continuum between healthy and unhealthy, the unhealthy one might be the one that after they're dead, they split it open, find the mattress full of $100 bills. but they're also, they can do that. People can do that not with just material possessions, but they can do that with their emotions. They can do that with their knowledge. They're afraid to trust. They've got to keep it all to themselves. It's too scary to share. The six is the stabilizer or the devil's advocate. They are very much into going by the rules. The rules were made to protect them. That's their boundaries. They want to know what the boundaries are, and they really like boundaries. But on the other end, they question the boundaries, and they can't decide whether to push against them or to live in them, and they just keep bouncing back and forth. They're real hard to nail down because they can't make a decision because it might be the wrong decision, and they're very, very fearful of retribution. The sevens are the eternal youth, Peter Pan. We'll always look for some way of having fun. We're going to avoid our pain as much as we can. We're not going to deal with it. We'll go have fun. of totally avoiding pain is, they're great to be around, they're a lot of fun. But at the same time, that they never get in touch with it. And so there's a lot of part of them that never matures because it takes pain to grow. And so, anything touching home with anybody yet? The important part is to only identify with yourself, because you have to know the other person extremely well to really, or be around them when there is a lot of chaos, to understand where they're, you know, how they're going to react. And the other part that I've learned about myself is there is a part of me that's a seven now through my growing. After you move out of your main characteristic, then you can feel yourself start moving through some of the rest of the Enneagram. And there's this one person that I've been really attracted to and have spent quite a bit of time with them. And I really label them as a seven. They're very much a lot of fun, but doesn't really get in touch with their pain. And then I started realizing that basically what I was doing was projecting on them all the things that was going on inside of me. And so a lot of it too is, if you find yourself pointing your finger at someone else, it's probably a mirror. So.
That's a psychological truth. I took a test once. You said that you don't test for these, but I remember taking a test for the Enneagram.
Is that right?
I was high in seven and the four. One of them was a very creative person.
That would have been the four.
That would have been the four. Okay.
Yeah, they're about, that's usually pegged as the artist, because they are inward. They're very in touch with the subconscious and able to bring a lot of nice stuff up. Yeah. So. Where did you take them? I'm interested.
Well, it was someone who used one of these recent books to develop some questions that you just went through.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there are some. There's lists of traits that you can read off, and that's what I was going to be doing later in the week. Mm-hmm. Yeah, did you... You act like you were going to say something, or you...
No, but couldn't be... Don't they all have the same traits?
Yes.
Number 8, and then we have the whole thing inside us.
Yes.
And then it comes out at different times.
Hopefully.
At different times we are on number 6, and at one time we may be number 1. Different situations.
That's the ideal, yes. That's the appropriate behavior for the situation, rather than our habitual behavior that we learned back when we were 4 or 5 years old to work in our family system. Yeah.
But I think that the interesting thing is as the heat gets hotter, and we get further out of our comfort zone, we do tend to go back to learned behaviors, and we have less of a choice, perhaps, of how we respond, unless we can really take a look at what's working and really what's not working, and
being able to recognize the flags.
Yeah.
Got all the information that I've got available for tonight without going deeper into each one of the characteristics.
I just have one more question.
Sure.
You know, there is similar to that which you've spoken about, you know, intuitive or thinking or whatnot, you know. You know what always happens to me on all those tests is I come out like, it's not valid, you know, like, part of almost even, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And would that be a two then, trying to please, be in every situation, being what it's called for, not because you would fail, not because that's how you really are, but you know that's what you're supposed to do in that situation?
I might want to explore it a little bit deeper, because from what you're saying there, the two, but also the six and the nine, kind of hit home when you're talking, because the six really lives in the shoulds. They are very much wanting to follow the different rules that have been made, spoken or unspoken rules. The nine is, you know what, I just realized, did I Did I even talk about the nine? I didn't,
eight,
did I?
Nine, eight,
oh, I'm sorry. Okay, let me back up here a minute. The eight is the controller. They, to find their security, they will take control of the situation. They take care of their loved ones. They want to do. They want to know everything that's going on in their lives, and they will be sure and tell you exactly how to do it, when to do it, and
for how long.
Yes, and how long. They're intimidators. They have a tendency of being able to puff themselves up and look larger than life. That's the leaders, and the nines are they identify with everybody. They merge with everybody. Have you ever been with someone who if they're around somebody that has an accent, pretty soon they've picked up the accent. Or they take on the personality of the person they're with. They're very much, they go with the flow with everything. And because they're so in the flow with everything, they're totally out of touch with themselves, and to make a decision or to act, they're totally powerless because they don't know where they stand. Because they're so identifying with the other person. So does that kind of see where...
Yeah, I'm afraid that would be me.
Oh, Swin Beth, and one of the comments I've seen in two or three books, that if you identify with all nine of these aspects, you're probably a nine. So, okay.
And of course you've been describing sort of the worst of the worst of the negative qualities, so...
And that's probably mostly what you'll hear.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's a whole, it's a continuum certainly, and
but it's been amazingly helpful to me in my relationships.
How did you discover it personally for yourself?
Personally for myself is when I grow up I want to be a spiritual director. I don't know if I'll ever get that grown up, but in doing that. I was on staff here at Holden for 2 years, and during that time I had some free time, and I explored what was I going to do, what I was going to do next. And I wrote to the University of Loyola and asked for their curriculum, and their reading, the recommended reading list, and the Enneagram was on it. And that really sparked my curiosity. I am a big fan of Myers-Briggs. I taught several times on to different courses, classes in my church and stuff on the Myers-Briggs, and that's how I got invited up here, because I mentioned it to Scott, and I've been trying to find the correlation between the two. And for those that are familiar with Myers-Briggs, for me the correlation between them is Myers-Briggs is more nature, and the Enneagram is nurture. The one is we inherited. It, to me, this is what I'm playing around with. We're talking theory here, but it's our temperament is who we are when we're born. It's there, and we just build on it and work on it. Where the Enneagram follows the temperament. From the temperament, however or whatever our family situation or our situation is as we're children, then we kind of head into one of these and fine-tune it, because that is what appeals to us, that's what works for us inside psychically. I'm an ENFP, which is very relationship-oriented, so therefore, sure, I'm going to go into a giver, because that I can find my own personal comfort zone there, because it's very relationship-oriented. So that's how I've, instead, which is, oh, I bet that felt good. which comes first, the chicken or the egg? In this case, the Enneagram is the chicken out of the Myers-Briggs egg. Well,
go in peace
and serve the Lord. Thank you very much.
Thank you.